I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. This week, we're going to finish up our interview with novelist, artist, poet, and YA author Benjamin Alida Sines. And also, by the way, as most of you already know, my first co-host when we first started Words on a Wire a few years ago. We had a chance to sit down in Studio B and talk about his work, talk about his life, what's been happening since he retired early. He was a professor here at the University of Texas in El Paso in our creative writing department for 23 years. He was the senior professor, but he decided to retire. And he retired earlier than most people. He could have taught for another, even 10 years. But there was a certain point when he decided he was in a position to where I think every writer wants to be, to where he could just write full time. So he made that choice to retire early. And although we miss him dearly, he's been crazy productive. He published two books this year, The Inexplicable Logic of My Life, which is already a bestseller, and a new collection of poems by Cinco Puntos Press called The Last Cigarette. And he continues to garner award after award. His books are being published not only in the United States, but in France, in the Middle East, in Latin America, all over Europe, actually, all over Asia. He is one of the most popular novelists, YA novelists in the world. And that's not an exaggeration. We left off our conversation about talking about why he's so successful. What does Ben do differently from other writers? Is he more talented? Does he work harder? And he said he doesn't think he's more talented than anybody else. What he thinks it is his desire, his want. He wanted to be a writer. And he talked also a little bit about his discipline as a writer. No matter what is happening in his life, he will take that time to write, and he will leave everything behind. And this, I think, is fundamental for any successful writer, to guard that writing time. And it's something that I have had to teach myself over the years. I've been a writer now for, I don't know how many years, 20 or so. And now I'm the department chair of creative writing, which means that I could wake up in the morning and check my email and be answering emails and going to meetings until nighttime. But I'm a writer, and I have to guard that time. And I want it too, Ben. So what I do is I write every morning before I even check my first email. I guard that time, and I enter into that creative space, what an athlete perhaps would call the zone, where everything tunes out except for what you're doing. And that's a lesson I've learned from my good friend, Benjamin Alida Sines. In addition to a bunch of other lessons, this conversation, if you listened to last week, which we already have archived, and then you're about to listen to this week, you're going to get a lot of nuggets of wisdom from Benjamin Alida Sines. He is one of the most dedicated and successful writers I know. And we're going to pick his brain and find out what it is that makes him go back to that document, that desk, that blank piece of paper every day, and to fill it and to publish, on average, since I've known him, two books a year. So listen in to part two of my conversation with my very good friend, Benjamin Alida Sines. You know, what's interesting is your success. If you look at your process, you look at your attitude, you look at your work, you look at the way you do things, a lot of what you do and have done, a lot of the choices you've made are incredibly consistent with some of the suggestions in success literature. For example, put first things first. You know, it's one of the cornerstones of a success literature, whether it's, no matter who wrote it, it's make sure you know what your priorities are. And you've done that. Writing was your priority. You would be willing to get somebody angry for not showing up at a meeting because writing was your priority. You knew what it was. And one of the other is begin with the end in mind. And I know the way you write novels, you've told me this before, is you know exactly where it's going to end. You know the very last
sentence. I know the last sentence.
And when you believe in something and you begin, you already know where it's going to end. And then gratitude. And also, you know, desire, that desire, you can't really achieve anything without that desire. And I don't suspect you've, you may have, I don't know, but I don't suspect you really read success literature. But were you aware that a lot of what you do as a professional and as a successful man is consistent with the success literature?
I never thought of that. Never entered my mind, but I'll tell you, if someone would ask me, to what do you attribute your success to, I would say I moved to the border and stayed, and I owe this place,
mm-hmm. El Paso Juarez,
El Paso Juarez, my career, because I was told many times, if you take that job at UTEP, do not expect to have a great career.
Right.
Someone once told me as well, a colleague, as if at the time she was right, she said, what are you going to do when the border is out of vogue? As if it had ever been in vogue in literary circles. I have built a career writing about the border, fictionally, an entire career. They told me that it was going to hurt me. In fact, it was my greatest asset.
Right. And, you know, that is, I remember the first time I met you, I was coming into town to do an interview because they were interviewing me for the position that I currently still hold. In the hiring process, it's a 2 or 3 day process, different faculty members are assigned different tasks with the new candidate. And your task was to show me around town. And so I remember you picked me up in your car, and I remember my first image of you, I go, wow, this guy looks like a good-looking Geraldo Rivera.
Oh, God. Yeah, I got that a lot.
We were younger back then. But one of the things that really struck me about you, and I found this to be consistent throughout your life, is how much you love El Paso.
I love this place. I do. And it's just that sometimes, you know, I've had a really kind of... sometimes chaotic life. And, you know, I used to be a priest, I was married, and I'm out as a gay man, and they're tumultuous. My life has been a little tumultuous, and I live my life in extremes and in contradictions. But a man like that needs some place to call home. And if it wasn't the literal apartment I was living in, or the literal home I was living in, I always felt that El Paso was my home.
Right, right.
And so it gave me a place, a belonging, when I was kind of exiling myself from life. And I still belong because this place, it's funny, and a place can't love you, but I feel that this place loves me.
Right.
I do.
Absolutely.
I feel loved.
Yeah, and we've had conversations before, you and I, about what rain means to you. Mm. And you talk a lot about rain in your latest book of poems, The Last Cigarette on Earth. In fact, even your dedication even mentions about something about whenever it rains in the desert, I think of you.
Yeah, it says, for Carlos, when I see the rain falling on the desert, I think of you.
What does rain mean to you?
You know, I feel like if they don't have the smell of desert rain in paradise, I don't want to go. It's incredible to me. When it rains, I always have to go see it. Because when you live in the desert, and because you are used to drought as a way of life, you know, rain is a miracle. And we understand that miracle. And I do understand that miracle. And it's like, in the book of Proverbs, there's a proverb that says, a man who is full tramples on virgin honey. But to a man who is hungry, any bitter thing is sweet. That's the, we're hungry for rain in the desert.
Right.
And any little drop of rain is just, we're grateful. And that is the way it is for me. And I can go out I even forget that we have any drought at all. I even forget that it's not going to rain for very long and it's going to go away. I just can be in the moment because it's so beautiful. It's really so beautiful. And, I remember my dedication to my book, my first book, Carry Me Like Water. I remember the dedication.
What was it?
Eres la lluvia en mi desierto.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, you are the rain in my desert.
Rain has always been so incredibly important to me. Mm-hmm. And you know, other places, you know, rains all the time. They have a different perspective on rain.
Right, right.
They really do. And to me, it's like, that is, it's taught me to appreciate the desert, but it's taught me to say that beautiful things are rare. Mm-hmm. And when you have that beautiful thing, if it's a person, if it's a moment, treasure it.
Right. You know, you're saying that you attribute your success, the way you put it, to El Paso and, you know, to this area. But it sounds to me like what you're also saying, or what one can imply from what you're saying, is that your success comes from your deep commitment, from your deep love for something that is oftentimes neglected, for the oppressed, for the underdog, I guess, you know, even to put it in other terms, because El Paso, as beautiful as it is very easily dismissed. It's like the rejected cornerstone in your life. You know, that idea that Jesus is the cornerstone that's been, that is rejected by everybody else. El Paso is a place that's very easily rejected. Your characters are characters that are easily rejected. You have this incredible political commitment, not just for gay rights, but for Chicano rights and for actually just the rights of everybody. And El Paso, in many ways, embodies that, the beauty that comes out of, you know, that it's a commitment.
Well, you know, but it's funny because it's about people's aesthetics and what they see important. I go often to major cities in this country, and sometimes my hosts always like, I said, from El Paso, and they're gleaming. So how do you like Seattle? How do you like Boston?
Right, because they want you to say, I wish I lived here.
Because you live in El Paso, you must be like, and I said, it's nice. I said, it's a nice town. I said, I mean, it's just a nice town. I said, yeah. I said, well, you know, I'm a curmudgeon. I'm not that easily impressed. Uh-huh. I said, you know, every time I go to a big city, I have to go find the poverty in the city because because you hide it away,
right?
You hide it somewhere, and you put me in a nice hotel, and I'm in a nice part of the town, and I go to these nice things, and you know, and it's all very glamorous, and that's all very nice. I said, but you know, you hide your poverty, and I think what I love about El Paso is that not only do we not hide it, but we don't want to. Wow. I said it's a terribly honest city to live in, and I said, you know, I'm not sure that I'd be able to deal with that kind of public dishonesty in your town.
You know, I'm from Fresno, and Fresno is a very violent town in many ways. It's a very poor town. It's very much like El Paso. When I first came to El Paso, I fell in love with El Paso immediately, and I feel at home here. I felt home right away. But I remember when I was applying for one of my first jobs, eventually, fortunately, I got this job and got to hang out with you for many years. But Spokane, it was in Spokane. And I think they kind of wanted me to take the job, and the dean was driving me around town, you know, showing me, and I says, where are the poor people? Where's the barrio? I want to see that. And he goes, well, okay. And so he starts to take me through this poor part of town. He wanted me to see that they actually had a ghetto and that they had a barrio. And I remember even one point he goes, okay, but there's going to be drug dealers and prostitutes around here. And I go, I just want to see it. So we started to go, he goes, I think that's one right there. And he would, you know, he's like indicating some woman standing on the corner. But it was just kind of funny that you say this, because it reminded me of that maybe there's something fundamental about that love for where we come from, whether it's Fresno or El Paso or poor neighborhoods, that maybe, you know, is fundamental to the sincerity of your work.
Well, you know, the thing about El Paso and Juarez is that their countries have thrown them away. I mean, Mexico doesn't care about Juarez. You know, Washington doesn't care about El Paso.
Right.
But there's something fundamentally honest about this place, because it doesn't pretend to be anything. All those major cities, they pretend to be all kinds of things.
Right.
Well, you know, and I love Chicago, and it's a great city, but let's talk about corruption, baby.
And let's talk about killings.
And murders and violent crimes and all of that. We don't have that. We're a safe city. We're a live and let live city, which in a way is better than being progressive in some ways.
Right.
You know, because people work hard here.
Right.
And they don't have. And they at least have some respect for other people who are in trouble because they've known trouble. And I love that. I love that we don't put on airs. You know, we don't. Great cities put on a lot of airs. And right. we are just who we are. And I want to be like the city I live in.
Oh, I want to be like that. I want to be like the city I live in. That's beautiful. You have how many books? 15, 12 to...
No, it's like 20-something now.
20, oh, my God.
With I have 20, I think, right now.
Yeah, I couldn't really find the exact number because I know that there's been quite a few. But when you look back, you started to write YA novels, I guess, kind of late in your career. Mm-hmm. Was that an accident? Did you set out to write a YA novel?
I blame Bobby and Lee Bird for getting me into the YA. I blame them and credit them because they wanted me to write one. And I was writing, I had written a rough draft of interconnected stories.
Last Night I Sang to the Monster?
No. Sammy Juliana in Hollywood.
Oh, that's right. That was the first one.
And they wanted to publish it as YA, and I changed it, and I did it that way. And the rest is history. I was already, when I hit the YA world, I was, at least by the movers and shakers in that world, they recognized my work.
Right,
and,
right.
And from the get-go.
Right. And you said something interesting to me the other day. I was telling you that I unwittingly wrote and published a YA novel, The Cholo Tree. I didn't know it was going to be a YA novel. And I said, but now I'm actually working on one that is going to be a YA novel. I know it's a YA novel. And so I started to try to read some YA novels. And you said to me, oh, I don't read YA novels.
Well, I don't, you know. Well, I do some, but I don't really because it's not that my repertoire of reading.
And so what that tells me is that the reason why you write YA novels and why you're so good at it is because you know how to write young people.
I do.
Why?
Because I'm a kid. I am. I can't help it. I can be a 17-year-old. I just wrote a book called The Story of Me and the Things I Like.
Uh-huh.
And it's written from the point of view of a 5-year-old. And I had
more fun.
I could, there's a little bit of a boy living in me. And also, I listen to kids. When I read to them, I listen to the way they think.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of logic to their associative. They're very associative in the way that they relate to things. And it's very unique.
Give an example of this.
Okay. So, my dad drinks coffee in the morning. That's my dog's name. He doesn't like coffee. He likes to sniff. And then he'll come back in the story about that he likes to sniff. His, uh-huh. He goes, my little brother sometimes smells bad because he's like a baby.
Right, right.
And he says, but coffee doesn't care. She just keeps right on sniffing.
I love that already. Yeah. I'm absorbed.
So they're like, it's just a little kid. And the things he thinks of. And he said he likes his older brother because his older brother doesn't... fights with him, and he tells him, if you like flowers and dance in the rain, people are going to think you're a little funny. And he says, I don't care if I'm a little funny. And even though my big brother doesn't like flowers, sometimes I think of giving him some. He's just a sweet little kid. I can write that because, I don't know.
Man, that's how you write poetry.
Yeah, associative.
Yeah.
Except for it's bigger and crazy things.
It has a larger scope, and it's not rooted in necessarily that YA or young person. But yeah, that's what I love about your poetry. Like your new book, The Last Cigarette on Earth, you have like the poem like, what is it called? It's called Translating Heidegger. And I love this because it does do that association and it loops back and it keeps bringing back these ideas. But it almost sounds like what you're talking about, the strength of your YA novels.
Yeah, and I work with that. I work with that kind of idea. I'm going to read you a section of this book to demonstrate my associative things. You go, I throw everything in except the kitchen sink, and I make it work.
Right.
Because
and if you do throw in the kitchen sink will lead you to something else, and ultimately you'll go back to the kitchen sink once or twice.
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so this is from The Last Cigarette on Earth, a book of poems. It's brand new, just out with Cinco Puntos Press, and you're going to read an excerpt from...
Yeah, for a minute. It's very long, so I'm going to read the whole poem.
From what poem?
What We Photograph. And it's got an epigraph from Graciela Iturbide, a photographer I much admire.
Yeah, you have her big collection of photos on your coffee table.
All of this is to say that in life, everything is connected. Your pain and your imagination, which perhaps can help you forget reality. It's a way of showing how you connect what you live and with what you dream, and what you dream with what you do. And that is what remains on paper. We are all photographers. Every day I get a picture, courtesy of the internet, photographs of friends, their children, their dogs, the aftermath of a snowstorm or a hurricane. I survived. The gala in New York, I missed because I had an appointment with a back surgeon. We missed you. We are always in search of the lost or perfect moment. The first thing children learn to do is pose. We place those poses in a frame and whisper, I was there. I was really there. Once I was young and alive. The art of the already dead. There, on the corner of El Paso Street and River, on the third floor balcony, tiny white blinking lights surrounded a hand-painted sign that reads, Imagine. The winter sun is setting, and the aura of the dusk in the calm and breezeless evening makes the world appear as if it is about to catch on fire. Is it God who holds the match? Or is it the hope and rage of the poor? We are afraid of rage. We should be more afraid of hope. I think it's me who holds the match. Sometimes I swear I could light the whole world on fire and join in the dance of the flames. I'm trying not to think of my skin on fire. I'm trying not to think of the pain. My camera is at home. Not that I need one. Not today, though I hang on to it for emergencies. You never know when you might need a camera. The perfect moment, psychology. Impossible to abandon. Was I there? Was I really there? For a time, I sit in my truck and whisper, Imagine. I try not to think of John Lennon. I try not to think of the last thought as he feels a strange bullet rip through his skin. I sit long enough to spell out the world. I-M-A-G-I-N-E. My body is a book filled with scenes like these. I sometimes turn to them in moments when my dreams threaten to swoop down on me. I can switch scenes in an instant, a talent I developed as a boy. There are days when I feel like a sparrow about to be snatched by a falcon in midair. Dreams have talons that can rip your skin like paper. In this, they are like bullets. I'm in love with sparrows. They are small and common and exist in every part of the world. There are sparrows in China and France and in England and in the deserts of America and Arizona. They are like Mexicans. What would the world do without sparrows and Mexicans? What would the world do without cameras?
Thank you. That was from The Last Cigarette on Earth, your latest book of poems. And I never really noticed, although it makes a lot of sense now, the similarities between your YA voices and your poetic voice. And they're different, but it's one of the things I love about your poems is the same thing I love about your fiction. We're going to have to do a flash lightning round because we're running out of time, and I have so many things that I want to ask you that I think people would really be interested in knowing about. 22 books or so, over 20 books. Your favorite one?
Oh, that's not fair.
I know, but you got to do it anyway.
But I do have one. It doesn't matter. In Perfect Light.
In Perfect Light. Okay, that's a novel. I remember when that came out. It's a beautiful novel. And I think your novels changed with that, didn't they? With
yes,
that
they
book.
It was a watershed novel for me.
Yeah.
As a writer.
Your prose changed with that book. There became a lot more dialogue, and it moved a lot faster, and the humor came out more in that book, I think, maybe in previous books.
And yet, it's my most painful book.
Yeah. It's a beautiful book. Writing process. What's your writing process?
I get up. When I start writing, I never move on. And when I finish a good chunk, I go back to it and rewrite it. And I'll go back until, when I finish a book, it's almost all been rewritten several times. It's done because I love to rewrite. I can't move on unless, you know, it's like, I'm not going to go clean the next room until this room is spotless.
Right.
That's how I feel.
That's a wonderful technique. Morning ritual.
Coffee and a cigarette. And really, I wake slowly, Daniel. And especially because I get more sleep and I'm really groggy. And I don't need an alarm. I get up groggy at 6:45 or latest and 5:45, and I'm groggy. And then I talk to my plants. I have to confess that. And I kind of touch them so they do well and, you know, greet the day. I open all the blinds because my apartment is surrounded by Venetian blinds, and I open them and let in the day. I put on the coffee. I go out and sit on the stoop. And I'm jonesing for a cigarette, right? But I'm going to wait because I'm going to wait until I have it with my coffee. delayed gratification. And then I sit and I don't really think about anything except for I just think, oh, the coffee's so good. And, you know, if I only had cigarettes and I only smoked them in the morning, that would be okay because it's so good. And everything seems so good. And then I wake slow and I have to talk to anyone and I have to be interactive. I don't listen to anything but music. And sometimes not even that. And then when I'm awake, I get to work. And then I'll write until 11, 12, 1, depends. And then I have, you know, I sometimes will stop and I have to return emails or some phone calls. And sometimes I do. I just go and take my cell phone and I put it in my bedroom because I can't hear it from there.
Right.
And I just say, you don't have to answer the phone.
Favorite time of day?
Favorite time of day. Mornings. Well, sometimes at night. Some mornings and night, quiet nights when I am reading a book in my office. And I'm so absorbed. And I stop because I just read something. And I go like, that's when I think of, this is such an amazing life I have.
I'd like to thank Benjamin Alida Sines for joining us on Words on a Wire. Thank you, Ben.
My pleasure, Daniel. Ask me back again.
Absolutely. That was my conversation with my good friend, author, and El Paso native, although actually he was born in Las Cruces, but I think we can call him an El Paso native. He loves this city so much, which is very evident in all his work. Benjamin Alida Sines. You can listen to last week's interview on KTEP webpage, Words on a Wire, and this week's interview will be posted soon, so you can listen to both of them. I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you, and see you next week.